Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And that debt is fraud, and it is now or never. And we are trying to keep you abreast and understanding this Constitution, how it was configured, and this whole process of holding our public servants accountable. It's if you really look at this, the whole process of nullification, the end, that being the ultimate, nullifying the laws, getting rid of this usurped power, getting rid of these unconstitutional regulations, laws, blah, 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 blah. It starts with interposition, and the ultimate act of wiping them out comes from the directives from the states, and Congress will either do their job or they will be replaced. We're not looking to hang anybody, at least not at this point. Now, Sean and I have talked about justice. We've talked about this need to, you know, ensure that justice is served. So those people who actually have committed treason, those people who have been selling us downriver by, you know, granting lucrative opportunities for corporations while they're invested in their stock so that they can walk away with millions of dollars, they're going to pay. There's no doubt in my mind. There's plenty of people out there that's been keeping track of all this stuff. And as long as the paper trail, as long as the evidence provides justice, you're going to get your justice. But you can't have your justice until we have them and we have our government demanding compliance to the Constitution. We have to have a majority. It has to start in your county, because it won't happen with one person. One person can run around with an ugly stick and beat people up all day until they die from exhaustion. That won't do it. It has to start at the state level. This is why the states have to do this. And when you look at the fact that because the states are the parties to the compact, that just proves that that solution, the way this whole design was done, literally is divine. We've just been ignoring it. So it's all about compliance with the Constitution. Now, we're going through Madison's notes. And as I dive into this, I've talked before about people attacking Madison. And, you know, being a person that's kind of read and watched what Madison did throughout his life, Madison evolved. I've evolved. I think we've all evolved. There are people that literally flip-flop like opportunist politicians. Like when people said that Madison flip-flopped on the National Bank. He didn't create the National Bank that Hamilton created. He only created a National Bank that was capable of taking on debt and executing the debt. I mean, the government was already capable of executing taxes, but we needed money, foreign investment, to be able to buy the resources to be able to fight that war. So anyway, I don't think Madison was a hypocrite. I think he just realized that in an emergency, that was the only mechanism he had. And they made it possible to retire the debt and get out from underneath that bank again. And what did Andrew Jackson do? He took credit for killing the bank, and he created a national banking system, which was basically getting the states on the hook of holding federal money, doing things that were just equally unconstitutional as creating a bank. Anyway, I digress. What we're going through right now is where Madison is, because Madison's already kind of covered earlier on the resolutions. And at this point, he's going through his report. So in other words, when you read his report, he justifies what they did and why he said, or they said what they said in the resolutions. In his notes, he does the exact same thing of justifying what they said in the resolutions. But now he's actually pointing to, this is why I said what I said. When I hear somebody tell me, you know, because they haven't read the notes, if they're telling me that Madison's all over the place here, because he's not. He's actually walking through everything he said and explaining why those things still stand. And so what we just read from paragraph 31 and 32 is literally where Madison is talking about, and the report, we're talking right around, let me see here, if the deliberate address exercise up above, let me see, this would probably start somewhere in 20 or 21, but 32 ends with paragraph 22 of the report. So in other words, he's citing these paragraphs in this part of the report where he's getting close to pointing to the court. And then right here in paragraph 33 is where he goes, aha. So what he basically was saying was explaining why the authority only belongs to the states. He wasn't saying, at this point in time in the report, he had said that the court can't have it. But he goes on further in the report, that's when he says that they can't have it and why they can't have it. All he's been explaining is why the states must be that tribunal, why they are the only tribunal of all things when it comes to the violations, the direct violations against that compact, especially usurp powers, especially dangerously palpable, blatant usurpation of power. So let me just welcome back Tammy, and let me welcome back Sean. And so let me see. Yep. I'm not sure who read last, but are there any go-backs that we wanted to cover for today? Sean?
Taking notes.
I don't have any.
All right.
Sir.
And hearing none, hearing no saved rounds, we can clear the firing line. So why don't I have, let me see, 33 is really a short one. So why don't we have
the firing line, sir?
Firing line is cleared. All right. So, Sean, why don't you go ahead and read 33 and 34. And then, Tammy, if you would, we're going to have you read 35 through 39. But 33 and 34 has some big text, so we'll probably want to expound on those things. But what I want to do is once we get through these next few paragraphs, when we get into the point of Jefferson, which is around the 50-paragraph level, that area right there, I think that what we'll just do is jump through the highlights because then we can kind of skip over the rest of the non-highlighted words and just kind of point out these other really important parts where Madison starts talking about ultra interposition and so forth. So anyway, let's go ahead, Sean, and take it off or kick it off with 33 with this aha moment. Go ahead.
Here is direct proof that the authority of the Supreme Court of the United States was understood by the legislature of Virginia to have been a less than, greater than, to an interposition of the states against the alien and sedition laws. I'm not sure what the bracketed thing was. It's missing.
Yeah, so I think that was probably to a person like Monroe or whomever, because I believe he forwarded these notes out to, and I know Monroe received them, but he just didn't enter the names and so forth. But these brackets.
Way back then.
Yeah, so these brackets right here, I don't know what this is pertaining to. So, again, these are just his notes, right?
Correct.
But for the most part, there's a lot of meat, there's a lot of gold. So, yeah, go ahead.
Who can avoid seeing the necessity of understanding by the parties to the constitutional compact, the authority which made the compact and from which all the departments held their delegated trusts? These trusts were certainly not delegated by a single party, by regarding the term parties in its plural, not individual meaning. The answer to the objection is clear and satisfactory. Take the term as meaning a party and not the parties, and there is neither truth nor argument in the answer. But further on the hypothesis that the rights of the parties meant the rights of a party, it would not be true, as affirmed by the report, that the delegation of judicial power would annul the authority delegating it, and that the concurrence of this department with others in usurped power, it might subvert forever and beyond the reach of any right or remedy the very Constitution which all were instituted to preserve. However deficient a remedial right in a single state might be to preserve the Constitution against usurped power, an ultimate and adequate remedy would always exist in the rights of the parties to the Constitution, in whose hands the Constitution is at all times but clay in the hands of the potter, and who could apply a remedy by explaining, amending, or remaking it as the one or the other mode might be the most proper remedy. I love the clay and potter.
Yeah, it's a great metaphor in understanding. Mm-hmm. So to be clear, though, if the states convene into a convention of states without going to Congress to say we're rewriting the Constitution, at this point they can't, because the Constitution literally requires that they have to petition. So this is a safe convention or a safe tribunal to where the states can literally work together, and instead of, you know, working through an amendment for themselves, they can actually create an amendment together where they can send it, like when we were talking about the 50 state judges, creating a Supreme Court of 50 judges, and then the Chief Justice would be the tiebreaker. If there is a 51st state added, then the president will have to add a second, temporary or an alternative justice, so that it would be the Chief Justice would still be the tiebreaker. That all being said, in the process of going through, reviewing, and making the determination, get rid of this, get rid of this, if there's a necessity that they need an amendment down the road to address very specific issues that they want the federal government to be involved in, like on taxation. And I'm throwing this out there just as so that we keep it very simple. When it comes to the union, there would be and probably would need to be a polity. Let's just say the Department of Transportation. Each state can manage its own, but to kind of create a strategy and to kind of create, you know, when we talk about transportation, it's not just roads, it's air. It's all forms of transportation. It could be infrastructure. It could be whatever we want to put under this, like even communications. Whatever we, you know, create that says, okay, we're going to have this interstate Congress. We're going to create a governing body that may have some limited law power that, you know, will require the state's complete buy-in, three-fourths, very similar to the Constitution in this polity, but it'll be very domestic in kind. And so once they pound out what that's going to be, then they would need to create an amendment to ensure that this body would be able to provide what their operational requirements are, because the states would actually have to buy into what their budget. In other words, it wouldn't be the president that would approve the budget. It would literally go out, kind of like the Senate, except the 50 states. There's no reason why the state legislatures can look at the budget of this governing polity. And by the way, this governing polity will not be in D.C. As a matter of fact, if you think about it, we could start creating a polity for energy. We could create a polity for, if we wanted to have educational standards, just standards. And or a think tank, not some regulating force. The best thing to do is to put it throughout the union. In other words, why allow one seaboard, one area of the nation to be sapped with all of the political influence and spheres and become, you know, this supposedly most hallowed ground in America? I believe that if you, you know, make it more distributive so that, you know, we've got in Nebraska, Montana, all over the place, where we've got these small governing boards or bodies that are focused on strategies, then one thing that would be necessary is to pay for these. So there would be an amendment to make sure that this governing body, once it has full concurrence from the states for a budget, they will forward that budget to the federal government. The federal government will make sure that they pay for that out of their standard revenues. Now, we look at their standard revenues being income, impost, excise, and so forth. Well, you know, there may be some cleanup, like we get rid of income and literally go back to duty taxes or what have you. This is how we move forward in actually having more control over everything that has an impact on our everyday lives instead of allowing bureaucrats to constantly sell us downriver in what meets the globalist agenda instead of our agenda. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And the reparations that we talked about could pay for that. All the money that we take back and confiscate from these criminals could be used for education in constitutional literacy in the states.
Yeah. So actually, and so when we confiscate those things, the question is, does the state confiscate Warren Buffett's assets? Does Washington State confiscate Bill Gates? And wherever Elon Musk lives as his primary residence, do they confiscate it? Do they get that? Or do we socialize that to say we all of these things and getting rid of these enemies of the union? Because that's what they are. They're collaborators with the federal government who has become an enemy of the union as well. Right?
I'll say you split it up 50 ways.
So I that's okay. I make suggestions. I don't know if I have a good suggestion to really come say, I think this is what we need to do. I believe that the 50 state legislatures will actually, or the majority of the legislatures will come up with the best way. Now, when everything gets started, let's say we've got 27 states. Let's look at it this way. We've got 27 states now actually carving up and dismantling the federal government. And they're coming into these ideas of how they can really serve themselves and, save themselves money, make the union far more thriving throughout the entire union and so forth and so on, to where I believe that the other blue states will come into this running and saying, hey, we want to have some say on this, because they're going to want to be able to be a recipient or at least persuade and offer good ideas. Now, whether they can influence the majority, I doubt it. But the fact is that it's like the fire attracts the moths. And so, as this fire starts burning and this opportunity of true liberty and unleashing the power of the union and the republic, I believe that these other states will, the people will demand that you get representations in there. You state legislature, you need to get, you need to become a part of this because it's that big, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I think it's interesting how these pressures kind of will build. But I ultimately, when people say, well, how will this truly be decided? It will have to be decided by a majority of the states. So it's going to take time. And as a matter of fact, if you understand the character of the people that we have in place that are working and in control now, control of Congress, the character of these people are going to be very similar to the character of the framers, where they, they're there to serve their state and they're there to preserve the Constitution and restore sovereignty back to the states and take back their powers. And they're going to realize that it's, at this point in time, because the potter's clay, they can actually start coming up with these ideas and submit amendments to the Constitution that would then go out, because Congress can concurrently be working on amendments coming from this body and forwarding them out for basic ratification, so that these other things could start being done instead of waiting. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
They're going to trip over solutions that will become so obvious to go, oh my gosh, we need an amendment for this right here. And one of those amendments is allowing the states to work together to create a policy center, to create maybe if a light governing body or a strategy, where everybody kind of agrees and ultimately comes to ensuring that the strategy will serve the union, because they'll have to have a majority. Or would it be a three-fourths rule? I think in certain cases we may want even a three-fourths rule to make sure that a democracy or just a simple majority can't swing us one way or the other. And I think down the road, if we actually start expanding where foreign states slowly get integrated into the United States, which is what they should do, instead of getting any assistance from us, they need to become self-sustaining and they need to be self-governing, just like the rest of the world, or just like us. And they'll be able to benefit from this. But if we have a majority, a high majority, then as they come in, their paradigms will, you know, if they're not completely solid on this new system, it'll give them time, and the union will be protected from an influx, because the influx can't be that fast. And as a matter of fact, you know, that's a part of the strategy too. How do we admit these states into the union where people want liberty in Taiwan? I mean, they're going to have to speak English. So all those things have to get worked out. And many of those things would actually fall under Congress. But the states, now that the potter's hands are on the clay itself, they can actually come up with these ideas to say and work through them. So that would actually possibly create another committee that would be working in tandem with the Republic Review Committee. Does that make sense?
It actually does.
When all of a sudden we become masters of our own domain, when a person actually has the ability to fully tap all of their resources, they become very powerful. They can do great things. And the only reason that they fail is because they were the weak link. So, and if you leave it to one person, there's a much more likelihood of failing. But when you actually are electing the best and those honorable men that want to be held accountable and so forth, honorable men and women that want to be held accountable to their oath of office and to supporting the Constitution. So anyway, with that, okay, so I've dragged that horse. It's got plenty of mud on it. Tammy, let's go ahead and read from 35 through 39. Thank you.
Such being the comment of the report, third resolution fully demonstrates the meaning attached to it by Virginia when passing it, and rescues it from the nullifying misconstruction into which the resolution has been distorted. Let it next be seen how far the comment of the, what's that stand for, representative, the repetition on the seventh resolution above inserted accords with that on the third, and that this may be more conveniently be scanned by every eye. The comment is subjoined at full length. Here is certainly not a shadow of countenance to the doctrine of nullification. Under every aspect, it enforces the arguments and authority against such an apocryphal version of the text. From this view of the subject, those who will duly attend to tenor of the proceedings of Virginia and to the circumstances of the period when they took place will concur in the fairness of disclaiming the inference from the undeniableness of the truth that it could not be the truth meant to be asserted in the resolution. The employment of the truth asserted and the reasons for it are too striking to be denied or misunderstood. More than this, the remark is obvious that those who resolve the nullifying claim into the natural right to resist intolerable oppression are precluded from inferring that to be the right meant by the resolution, since that as is as little denied as the paramountship of the authority creating a constitution over an authority derived from it.
Right. Okay, so that final line, and as a matter of fact, I've never heard paramountship. In other words, of the utmost, you know, paramount, or the utmost necessity. This is paramount. Anyway, paramountship, interesting. But at that very last line, he's basically saying that it is paramount. It is the utmost importance to ensure that the authority creating the Constitution will always have the authority over that entity that's derived from it. And therefore, as we, you know, as we create these polities will have to have a very limited and defined constitution in allowing them to assemble, to, you know, create an office space or have a building in some town in Nebraska, who knows, wherever. But we're running into a break. So when we come back, I'll kind of wrap up this concept and idea of what Madison is talking about, of how the parties must always, and based on the tenets of contract law, they always are the superior party in relationship to the creature they've created. I'll be right back after this. I'll get into it.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me, since I'm not going to rush this analogy, because I want you to understand what Madison is talking about, how this truth, this undeniable truth, it can't be refuted. When you look at the DNA of the Union, what is that? The DNA of the Union is a portion of every state or every member in that Union. So when they created that creature, and when they created the Constitution that creates that creature, they made a mechanism in that Constitution to allow other contributors into the Union to expand, you know, virtually when that expanse occurs. So in other words, even though the creature may have only had 13 members' DNA in it, when all of a sudden expanded to 3 over a short period of time, each time it expanded, automatically that member's DNA, because they became a part of the Union, now became a part of the DNA of that creature. And so as we now have 50 parties to the Union, the creature has 50-party DNA in it. It is a servant of all 50. When you go through that process, and it's interesting that the federal government was given the process of doing this. This is why we went through Article 4, Section 3, in minute detail, that there is no power delegated to the federal government other than admitting this is a role and responsibility to prepare territories into becoming states, to prepare them and help them become a state that will step in full sovereignty capacity. In other words, the baby's job is to make sure that the new parents coming into this union were going to come in with complete equal status. The baby got smart, and the baby got smart 20 years later, because in 1816, less than 20 years, it started taking a little bit out of each of the parents coming in their own constitutions, getting these new parents or these new DNA contributors to the union to create a constitution that placed a little holdback, recognizing the federal government having more authority within their state, having a little authority, a little more, a little more, and a little more. To the point that after the Civil War, public land was a standard. You actually read in constitutions where this use and this term of public land is literally there. Public land means the land belongs to the government at hand. If that is in the county, that is county public land. Does the state own all the counties? No. The state was created to serve the counties. Does the federal government own all the land of the state? No, it was there to serve the union. All that land in that state is state land. Other than those lands delegated in the Constitution, forts, magazines, arsenals, shipyards, and needful buildings, that's it. Just because, and we covered this, just because the word territory is in the Constitution doesn't mean that they have the authority to possess territory forever and ever, and it's always theirs. No, they. If you look at territory, it is in the responsibility of taking that territory and preparing it to admit states of the union, which is why it's in that very particular part of the Constitution. So as the union decides to say, we want to grow, and we want to spread liberty throughout the land, and they decided with manifest destiny to run with it from the East Coast to the West Coast. And they did it. The union decided to do that because the federal government was representative of the people, and the people ran with it. And so the federal government's job was to make sure every state joined the union with equal footing and full sovereignty. And they didn't do that. And so over time, people said, well, how did you guys do that? Well, the courts created this, I'll just call it this, this jabberwocky talk. Literally, they used legal babble to say that this is all legitimate now, because they've been getting away with redefining and creating law and so forth. And there's way too many people that have just bought into all of this. If it's not in the compact, it's not legitimate. Therefore, as what Madison is saying, this truth is undeniable. It's irrefutable. So when we get into, and when people start understanding this, because every time I talk to somebody and say, you know, this whole Republic review process could be taken over and run away. Everything, anything can be taken over and run away. No, it can't be, because it operates on the truth that the states are the ones that have the authority. The federal government cannot have any of this without amendments to the Constitution to grant them the authority to do that. And what usually happens is when all of a sudden somebody wakes up or somebody tells them, hey, did you know that you actually own all of these things? As soon as they're told that these things that they didn't think were theirs, now they're all of theirs, the last thing they're going to do is want to just give those back to whomever took them from them in the first place. Is that not the truth? Tammy, Sean, what do you think? I mean, do you think anybody would be quick to give up the stuff that somebody had already taken from them and now realize, hey, they never had the authority to do that. It's yours now. I don't think they'd be so apt to do that, yeah. Right? All right. So as we look at this process, this tribunal, the whole point is getting the government into the tight constraints that it is supposed to be operating in. How do you derail that? Well, the only way you derail it is giving them more power by giving them amendments and those types of things. Any amendment, the amendments need to come from this body, this tribunal, and that amendment needs to be fixing the problems. And so if it doesn't fix the problems, it's not going to get passed. But I will tell you that those who actually have their heart and their soul in the game here of restoring our liberty, restoring and reclaiming the republic, there's no doubt in my mind, there's none, that they will actually be able to get this done, because you can't. It's almost like when I look at how Hamilton tried to pollute the Constitution in the Constitutional Convention, couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. The only way he could start attacking the Constitution was from documents and efforts outside of the Constitution. In other words, the implied powers. Oh, something that's not in there. Oh, there's implied powers. And God, we believe it's implied. The Constitution was never justified that way. And as a matter of fact, now that we have the truth from the ratification debates, that becomes an axiom. That becomes a gold standard. Hey, there are no implied powers. That gets wiped out. It's been this myth. It literally has become folklore that these implied powers exist. They created the folklore. And who did that? The courts. And the courts used the Federalist Papers, another document outside of the Constitution, to basically say, you have these powers. And they used these non-legitimate documents to say, these documents say we have these powers. No wonder the courts basically lauded and praised and used the Federalist Papers solely as their guide. Wouldn't you? I mean, if all of a sudden somebody handed you this piece of paper that will allow you to steal the world from everybody. Wow. You know, I have this, and over time I could start getting people to believe that this thing is giving, you know, like, you know, just some concocted idea that Hamilton created. Hamilton died before these things started bearing fruit. But these men guarded their secrets. They guarded exactly what was happening. They didn't come out and say, no, we're assuming power. No, they're saying that this is implied power that we have under this Constitution, when actually the implied power is coming under the Federalist Papers. And the Federalist Papers were just a bunch of editorials that ran in New York newspapers to help New Yorkers kind of, you know, seek their delegates who would ratify it. But there was a lot of resistance in New York, but nevertheless, I digress. Anyway, so this idea of using DNA, you know, of the Union, because every time a member joined, that would also just go into the gene pool. And it was basically that gene pool was transferred into the creature, you know, simultaneously. Does that help? Does that help kind of understand this whole relationship of the Union to the creature?
Yeah, it helps.
Okay.
Kind of.
So how can, because what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get it so that this just becomes, aha, you know, it's just that simple. How would I make it more simple, Sean?
The potter and the clay. I love that.
Yeah,
because
so you have
another potter that comes in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yeah,
but it's still clay.
Yeah, but there are 13 parties, or the DNA of that party is 13. So I'm just trying to help people understand that the party is the Union, and when we get a majority of the Union, that becomes the potter. Once you have a majority of the Union, now you have that level of control to basically grab that clay. You can't amend it because there are other requirements to do that, but you can start holding your public servants accountable to that Constitution at that point. But to start molding it, amending it, and, you know, fixing problems with it, that requires an Article 5 process, period, because the Constitution dictates that. Not the creature, our Constitution, the Constitution we created. So I'm just trying to help people understand who that potter is, because a potter is just a person. But that person is actually a conglomerate or an amalgamation of all of the states in the Union at all times. So, in other words, as it went from 13 to 15, 15 to 10, or 12, and on, as it grew up incrementally, I'm going backwards here, but, you know, 12 to 20, 20 to 30, 30 to 40, as it incrementally grew by 1, 2, whatever the increments were, it doesn't matter. The potter DNA then enriched itself with these new states in the Union, and it became, it's like a marriage. I mean, when a state joins the Union, it's in there. It now becomes an equal recipient as well as an equal bearer of responsibility. So that's what I'm trying to do. I mean, what Madison is saying here is very simple, but I want to make sure that the people that get tripped up with kind of understand, well, hold on here, who's the potter? Well, the potter's the Union. Well, shouldn't it be 13 potters? No. Because the way the Union is formed, it functions as a single body, right?
Right, I got
okay.
you.
Okay. And so it's kind of like a marriage. Is a marriage a man and a woman, or is a marriage a man and a woman becoming one?
Becoming one.
There you go. So the Union is becoming one with the many. That's why I say when a state joins the Union, they don't join the Union with the states closest to it. They join the Union with every state in that Union. In other words, it's a one-to-many relationship. They say, we're coming on and joining you, Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, and literally going through every state. We're joining you by name and getting to the last one and say, and we're committed to being with you all, because it's like a marriage. But people have a hard time understanding, putting this to marriage. Potter and clay, it's a little bit easier.
Especially nowadays.
Yeah, but now that we can kind of understand gene splitting and all of that, and now we can, you know, put the DNA together to kind of create, you know,
mirrors.
Yeah, so we can create, you know, a offspring that inherits a little bit of DNA from all of the parties included, if that makes sense. So anyway, It's kind of like ore. I know that when you get ore and you start refining it, you can get ore from all 50 states and start actually, you know, mixing and melting, and it gets to a point where it is completely amalgamated or completely mixed into it. So anyway, hopefully that helps. I just wanted to take the time to kind of get into this, because once you start understanding this, folks, you'll realize just how hard it is to undermine this and actually derail this. So, Sean, you're up next. And I think, where are we at? We're starting off with 40? 40. Or is it 39?
40.
Okay. 40. All right.
The true question, therefore, is whether there be a constitutional right in a single state to nullify a law of the United States. We have seen the absurdity of such a claim in its simple, naked, and suicidal form. Let us turn to it as modified by South Carolina into a right in every state to resist within itself the execution of a federal law deemed by it to be unconstitutional, and to demand a convention of the states to decide the question of constitutionality, the annulment of the law to continue in the meantime and to be permanent unless 3/4 of the states concur in overruling the annulment.
In other words, South Carolina was saying either you amend the Constitution to make this a part of the Constitution, or we're not going to follow it. And just keep in mind that in some cases these laws might be in pursuance to the Constitution, and they may not like that law. See, South Carolina was complaining. So what was the law they were complaining about? It was tariffs against certain countries that were competing with the northern states' products. Mm-hmm. And as South Carolina, or I should say the southern states, wanted to be able to buy those things on, you know, a cheaper cost, and instead of having to pay the inflated price from those states up north. In other words, it was very punitive to the southern states when they couldn't buy it, because these were protectionist tariffs, and they didn't like that. Technically, they can do this. It's within the Constitution for them to do. Well, they said, okay, then you have to amend the Constitution to be able to allow that to, you know, for this particular law to go through. And what that would have required, it would have required all sorts of stupid laws once they got created to be added into the Constitution, to subjoin the Constitution to it. And that's why Madison was basically saying, this is crazy. They're creating a law that they have the derived power to. You want to annul it and then say, we need 3/4 of the states to say that this particular law is going to be legitimate. Anyway, does that make sense? And then he goes down into this, he goes down into the numbers in 41. And Tammy, you go ahead and pick this up, because he points out 7 and 6, 17. Because I think at this point in time, in how many states were in the Union in 34, and how many states were in the Union in 98? Do you guys know? Anybody know?
No.
Okay, you go look it up, and I can tell you, because I've got it all down. So I'll pull up a document. So, Tammy, go ahead and knock out 41, please. Thank you.
Thus, during the temporary nullification of the law, the results would be the same with those proceeding from an unqualified nullification. The result of the convention might be that 7 out of the 24 states might make the temporary results permanent. It follows that any state which could obtain the concurrence of 6 others might abrogate any law of the U.S., whatever, constructively, and give the Constitution any shape they please, in opposition to the construction and will of the other 17, each of the 17 having an equal right and authority with each of the 7. Every feature in the Constitution might thus be successfully changed, and after a scene of unexampled confusion and distraction, what had been unanimously agreed to as a whole would not as a whole be agreed to by a single party. The amount of this modified right of nullification is that a single state may arrest the operation of a law of the U.S. and institute a process which is to terminate in the ascendancy of a minority over a large majority in a Republican system, the characteristic rule of which is that the major will is the prevailing ruling will. And this newfangled theory is attempted to be fathered on Mr. Jefferson, the apostle of republicanism, whose own words declare that acquiescence in the decision of the majority is the vital principle of it. See his inaugural address.
Okay, so as I look at this, the 17 and 7 making 24 states, the 24th state, when we had a union of 24 states, was 1820, before Missouri joined the Union. And so I think Madison was just using the numbers as an example, not as a specific point in time, because South Carolina was making the claim, and I don't think that they were using any numbers or anything else to that degree. I just think it was just him arbitrarily trying to make the comparison of the lunacy of trying to allow a consortium, a body of seven states, to dictate and rule the 17. Because I don't think any state, when you understand each state being sovereign, I don't think that those 17 sovereign states would, you know, appreciate. I mean, it's one thing that one state can actually cause a ruckus in the Union because it's sovereign. The state of Wyoming could cause a ruckus in the Union because it has the power to actually open up and speak the frankness of what's going on and literally start getting other states to join it. That's the power and the sovereignty of this union, period. And so these, and this is really just the fundamental design of this Constitution that, to me, keeps on pointing to the divine nature of its creation. Because it's amazing to me to think that it would only take one state to initiate the saving of the Union. Not a president, not a person. Because typically when we look through the annals of history, it's always been at the hands of a tyrant or a hands of a noble man, you know, of freeing the people, a prophet, what have you. But the design in the Union itself, when it is so complex and everything else, that a single state can initiate as the catalyst in calling upon all other states to join in the process of interposition or interposing and reaching nullification of undoing all of these unconstitutional laws. We don't have to live with this anymore. So to me, that's amazing. It's just amazing how when we look at the representation of choosing the president goes down and it boils down to the states, right? The president is chosen in Congress, even though the Electoral College is more of a popular vote type of thing. But when it comes down to it, it preserves the state sovereignty in choosing the president in the 12th Amendment. I think that's one of the reasons why, as we get smarter and smarter on this, the rhetoric on a popular vote and going straight into a democracy is what the progressives are really trying to push with the kids. Anyway, I digress. So
yeah,
let's dive into 42, and let me see here. This is where he starts talking about Mr. Jefferson. And in 44, this becomes, you know, really big and bold. 44, 45, 46. So at this point, Sean, why don't you read 42 and 43, and then we will kind of mull that out, and then we'll go into the following. Because once we get through this, then we'll actually just start hitting the highlights. So go ahead and read 42, and then let's take a look at the time, because we got about 3 minutes and 40 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, might Virginia declare, as her legislature did by a resolution of 183, that her resolution of 98 and 99 gave no support to the nullifying doctrine of South Carolina. And well may the friends of Mr. Jefferson disclaim any sanction to it or any constitutional right of nullification from his opinions. His memory is fortunately rescued from such imputations by the very document procured from his files and so triumphantly appealed to by the nullifying partisans of every description. In this document, the remedial right of nullification is expressly called a natural right, and consequently not a right derived from the Constitution, but from abuses or usurpations, releasing the parties to it from their obligation.
Okay, yeah, so keep going. Go ahead and keep going. Yeah.
Okay. No example of the inconsistency of party zeal can be greater than is seen in the value allowed to Mr. Jefferson's authority by the nullifying party. Whilst they disregard his repeated assertions of the federal authority, even under the Articles of Confederation, to stop the commerce of a refractory state, whilst they abhor his opinions and propositions on the subject of slavery, and overlook his declaration that in a republic, it is a vital principle that the minority must yield to the majority. They seize on an expression of Mr. Jefferson that nullification is the rightful remedy, as the shibboleth of their party, and almost the sanctification of their cause. But in addition to your inconsistency, their zeal is guilty of the subterfuge of dropping a part of the language of Mr. Jefferson, which shows his meaning to be entirely at variance with nullifying construction. His words in the document, appealed to as the infallible test of his opinions, are, thus the right of nullification.
No, that's okay. So go ahead, stop. I'm sorry. It just took me a second to get to my volume, because I mute myself when you're reading. Okay. So this is what really jumps out that I just wanted to help everybody kind of notice. Did you notice anything about the inflammatory or disdain these men had with Mr. Jefferson's personal thoughts and his ideology? Did you notice that that was included in here?
Oh, yeah. And I thought it was very good because he's saying, oh, they want to nullify this and not listen to the laws, but they got a problem with him and his ideas on slavery.
There you go. So, okay, so how many times do we hear Mr. Jefferson, you know, was, a defender of slavery? It's all the time, the way he's been mislabeled. Here's Madison. Jefferson's dead. And Madison is literally defending this man's honor from the grave. And so, you know, when you read these types of things, and it gets into this, especially when it talks about, when the topic includes a close friend, like we see here, where he's talking about Mr. Jefferson. Madison takes umbrage. He takes umbrage, and he's going to let them have it. You can tell that this is not Madison's typical letter. This is not his typical correspondence. He's very emotional, and he's hitting them, and he's hitting back. So when we come back, we're going to dive back into paragraph 44, and we'll kind of wrap this up in our next episode. And so that way we can, or in a following episode subsequently, we'll let you know. And it may surprise you in the next episode. I've got to look it up because we've got Christmas coming up and I've got to find out where we are. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.